compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show. Thank you for listening. We're officially open for business. You can call right now. The number is 888-914-9149. We had a great time together yesterday. I was listening a little bit to the replay later in the day and just really touched by some of the amazing phone calls that we got and just the questions and issues that came up yesterday.
Yes, that's true.
And as I reflected on that, I thought, you know, it's not actually out of character when you consider day by day, week by week. Some of the things we cover here on the Patrick Madrid Show are truly remarkable. And if you want to prove that to yourself, just go back and listen to some of them. We also have highlights on the show page. I think we call, what do we call them? Powerful moments, I think. And if you go to relevantradio.com/Patrick, you can find them there. Also, the same thing is true for our YouTube channel. So we've got tons of excerpts from the show on specific themes available on the Patrick Madrid Show channel on YouTube, which is another good resource if you have kids who are away from the faith or someone you care about who's away from the faith or maybe never been much into God at all. And if you go through those different topics that we have segregated for you on the YouTube channel, as well as on the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick, you'll find things on topics that might be perfectly suited for your son or daughter or that friend or loved one that you want to reach out to. And it's as easy as just sending them a link. Copy and paste the link, shoot it over to them, text it to them. You know they're looking at their phones anyway. So they're going to get a link and a YouTube video. They'll watch it.
That's almost ingenious right there.
That is true. May I say to you. I want to share this with you because, as you know, as well as anybody, this country has become increasingly divided, increasingly polarized. And we've talked a lot about that phenomenon, but it's interesting to look at it from the other perspective. What are things that we have in common? What are things that bring us meaning in life, regardless of your political proclivities? Maybe you're a Democrat, maybe you're a Republican, maybe you're unsure what you are anymore. I think that sort of describes me nowadays. I feel like a man without a country kind of thing. But in any case, transcending our differences, there are things that we have in common. And I was drawn to the data from a Pew Research poll that was taken in February of this year. They polled 2,596 U.S. adults. And they asked an open-ended question. The question was, what about your life do you currently find meaningful, fulfilling, or satisfying? And what keeps you going and why? So as the data that I'm going to share with you shows, there are areas in which Republicans and Democrats, so they're looking at it through a political lens. Most people in this country are either Republican or Democrat. A few fall between the cracks, but most people are either one or the other. So what emerges is some interesting areas where we have commonality, where we are interested in the same things. And then, don't you know, there are areas where it's widely different between the two political parties. So here's what they found out. So they evaluated the answers and grouped them into the most commonly mentioned categories. Both Republicans and Democrats are most likely to say that they derive meaning from their families. They also commonly mention friends and careers and material well-being. And again, the question that was asked to them was, what about your life do you currently find meaningful, fulfilling, or satisfying? And what keeps you going and why? So I think, first of all, that's a sign of hope that both Republicans and Democrats, even though they may be extremely divided on so many other topics, at least they can agree that their families are important, their friends are important, and to a lesser extent, I would hope, career and material well-being is also important, are also important. But Republicans and Democrats differ substantially over several other factors, including faith, freedom, health, and hobbies. In fact, even some of the world's, I'm sorry, in some of the words that partisans use to describe where they draw meaning in life, even those words differ substantially. So Republicans, according to Pew Research, Republicans, along with independents who lean toward the Republican side, they're much more likely than Democrats or Democratic-leaning independents to mention words like God or freedom, country, Jesus, and religion. Democrats are much more likely than Republicans to mention words like new, dog, and that's referring to the animal, reading, outside, daughter, and nature. Let me repeat those for you. So they did like a word cloud survey, and which words got the most play between the two different groups. So for Republicans, the very often mentioned words included God, freedom, country, Jesus, and religion. Democrats, those words don't even hardly show up. For them, it's words like new, dog, reading, outside, daughter, and nature. Democrats, they say, are most likely to mention new in the context of learning something new, but some also mention it in the context of new experiences, meeting new people or other forms of exploration. So here are some more data as they explored the partisan differences in more detail, and they show how attitudes in the United States compare internationally based on surveys conducted among 16 other public survey samplings in the spring of 2021. Republicans are much more likely than Democrats to cite religion in their life. People in both parties mention spirituality, faith, and religion as a source of meaning, with specific references to participating in traditional religious practices, such as attending church services, as well as more general references to a life informed by faith. One Republican woman, for example, said, "My faith and the ability to choose to be thankful, optimistic, and joyful are what keeps me going." Overall, though, around 1 in 5 Republicans and Republican-leaning independents, this is about 22%, say that spirituality, faith, or religion gives them meaning in life, compared to only 8% of Democrats and those who lean to the party. Evangelical Protestants, a heavily Republican group, are especially likely to mention faith and religion as a source of meaning. That's 34%. Smaller shares do so in other religious groups, including those following the historically Black Protestant tradition, that's 18%, or mainline Protestants, that's 13%. And this was very disappointing to me, and that is that Catholics, they clocked in at 11%. 11% of those surveyed, being Catholic, or 11% of Catholics, let's put it that way, said that spirituality, faith, or religion gives them meaning in life. How can that be? It's certainly not true for those of you who listen to Relevant Radio. I'm certain of that. And then the number drops off a cliff down to 2% if you identify as atheist or agnostic or nothing in particular. Republicans are also particularly likely to mention God and Jesus. One Republican man said, "Life without Jesus is meaningless. It's sad and hopeless. It is only through a daily relationship with Christ that joy, love, peace, and goodness can be found." I kind of endorse that. I agree with that. Republicans are more likely than Democrats, that's 12% versus 6%, to bring up freedom and independence as something that gives their life meaning. Some people mention freedom in the personal sense, focusing on their ability to live the way they want, their work-life balance, or having or wanting free time. One Republican woman said, "I like being able to have the freedoms to make my own decisions and to be able to contribute to my country, being able to express my views without worrying about retribution." I think those days are long gone, madam. I think they're long gone. "I feel for you, and I agree with you. But nowadays, it's hard to express your views publicly without retribution." Others, Pew says, emphasize freedom in a more political sense, highlighting things like freedom of speech and religion. One Republican man said, "Keeping the true meaning of being an American, country first, defending the Constitution, and freedom of speech." Democrats are more likely than Republicans to cite physical and mental health as part of what gives them meaning in life, and they mentioned the COVID-19 pandemic more frequently. When the survey was fielded in February, some 13% of Democrats and 9% of Republicans mentioned health, whether people's current state of well-being, their exercise regimens, or the steps they take to lead healthy lives. For some, health is also a precursor for other sources of meaning. One Democratic man put it this way, "The biggest thing for me is health. If you don't have your health, you don't have much. Everything else can come later, but you have to have your health." Well, that's true. But you can't go to the grocery store and say, "Hey, I'm in good health. Can I have all those groceries?" 1 in 5 Americans who mentioned health also mentioned the COVID-19 pandemic, including 23% of Democrats and 17% of Republicans. And while Democrats and Republicans were about equally likely to mention COVID-19 in the context of difficulties or challenges that they faced, the specifics varied by party. One Republican woman, for example, said, "My family is my only driving force. Being forced into a year-long quarantine isn't making that easy." On the other hand, a Democrat woman said, "Though COVID is a constant worry, I have faith we will come through eventually and that President Biden will be able to unite our country." Democrats were also much more likely than Republicans to mention COVID-19 in the context of the country and where they live, 23% versus 6%, suggesting that for Democrats, the pandemic has more of a societal dimension than for Republicans. Democrats, Pew Research says, are more likely than Republicans to find meaning in hobbies and recreation, nature and the outdoors and pets, though small shares of Americans overall mention these things. Overall, only 1 in 10 Americans say hobbies are a source of meaning in their life, and even fewer say the same about nature. That's just 4%. And I was surprised by this figure. Only 3% across the board said that pets gave them meaning in life. I figured that would have been a far larger number. Democrats are about twice as likely as Republicans to cite each one as a source of meaning in their life. Among Democrats, liberals are more likely than moderates and conservatives to find meaning in hobbies, nature, and pets, but there are a few ideological differences among Republicans on those topics. And there's just a last little bit here I'll share with you. Conservative Republicans are particularly likely to mention their country or where they live as a source of meaning. Among Republicans, 16% mention the country, patriotic and national sentiments, or the state of America's economy or society as a source of meaning, compared with 12% of Democrats. But conservative Republicans, that's 21%, are particularly likely to mention society relative to moderate and liberal Republicans, only 9%, while there are no major ideological differences among Democrats. One Republican man said in a description of what gives him meaning in life, he says, being born in America. One Republican woman said, "I am first-generation American, and I think this is the greatest country in the world, and I'm very grateful to live here." Partisanship is associated with Americans' views about the meaning of life more than it is in other parts of the world. In most of the 17 public groups that were surveyed, those who support the governing party and those who do not differ little when it comes to the factors that bring them meaning in life. So in the United Kingdom, as an example, these are the same kind of poll but taken in other countries. So in the UK, those who support the governing Conservative Party are just as likely as those who do not support it to mention freedom, religion, and other factors as sources of meaning in their lives. So if you're interested and want to look at these details here, I find them fascinating. I derive some hope from this, honestly, because it seems as though there is some common ground. There are days when it sure doesn't look like it, but I was happy to see that there's some common ground regardless of one's political affiliations. And maybe that's where we can meet in the middle and try to mend fences and, you know, get to know our neighbors once again as fellow Americans. I know it sounds like a daunting task, but not only do I think it can be done, but it must be done if you ask me. I mean, I don't know. Cyrus, at your Thanksgiving festival, was there any political talk around the Thanksgiving table, or did you guys stick to the weather and the ball games and family stuff?
I'm trying to think back. Nothing political came up. No.
How about COVID?
Yes. Yep, we talked about COVID. Was it tense? Living in fear. Mm-hmm. No, it wasn't. We have some differing viewpoints on the state of affairs, but it never got. It was just conversation.
Yeah,
it didn't get out of hand.
You were too busy with the turkey and stuff.
Yeah, it's hard to argue when you're full of turkey.
Your mouth is full. Uh-huh. Yeah, and the cranberry jelly is dribbling down your chin as you lunge for another dinner roll. Yeah, I can picture it. Well, you know, there are many people in the country for whom the holidays are particularly difficult because family gets together and, you know, it used to be...
We do have family members that have left. I mean, for all intents and purposes, they've left the family because,
politics?
Yeah, because of politics. I have one person on the family that... Him and his wife voted for Trump, and their kids are no longer talking to them. How ridiculous is that?
I know.
And
it goes the other direction, too.
And it certainly does. And that's just one example.
Mm-hmm. I hear you. And I think many people around the country, including many who are listening right now, are nodding their heads and saying, yeah, you know, Thanksgiving was weird and it was tense and we had to avoid certain topics because if somebody brought it up, like COVID or vaccines or Republicans versus Democrats or Trump or whatever, it would just spin out of control very quickly.
Yeah, it's really sad. We have one family member who is, she's lesbian, and the grandparents who are very Christian and mm-hmm. and conservative values. I remember years and years and years ago, my
careful. I know that feeling where you're walking on the edge.
Yeah.
I gotta be careful.
Where someone, you know, in the hierarchy of the family was like, I will never support someone in my family that is gay. I will not support them. Well, 20 years later, someone came out as gay, and you know what? He loved them and he supported them in his own way, but he still was firm in his value system. And even though he's showing support and love to this person who's now an adult, she's like 25 years old, mm-hmm. And married to a woman, so she's married to a woman, they no longer communicate with their grandparents, even though the grandparents are loving them and accepting them in their own way. But since they don't do it fully and completely dive in to that lifestyle,
acquiesce and just give in and say, okay, I'm totally on board with this.
They've ostracized them. They don't respond to emails, texts, presents have been sent. There's absolutely zero mm-hmm. response from the younger generation.
That's not only very sad, but I'd say that it's shameful to treat family members that way. I know a family, I'll leave it at this, I won't say anything more specific, but I know a family and one of the daughters has gone down that same path. So she's now an adult. She's living her life. She's living with a woman. And another sibling of hers got married, and one of the grandfathers sent the daughter who is living this lifestyle an email saying, we'd love to see you at the wedding. Hope, because, you know, she lives in a different part of the country. We'd love to see you. We hope to see you. Please come. But come by yourself. Don't bring your significant other, because if you're going to bring your significant other, it would be better that you not come at all. Now, I don't think he cleared that with, you know, like the parents of the one who's getting married, but she not only didn't go, but I think it caused a further rift.
Of
like,
course.
Okay, if you can't accept me for who I am, then I'm done with you. And the pain that these families experience is incalculable.
Yeah, it's really sad. We're only on this planet for a short time. And, you know, forgiveness and acceptance are such an important part of every day.
That is true. And I will add to that. We have to take a break in a second. I will add to that. Forgiveness and support and acceptance, those are all important. But so is truth. And the difficult line to walk at times is, if you speak the truth in love and somebody turns his back on you, did you do something wrong? I don't think so. You have to speak the truth in love and hope that things don't fall apart, but unfortunately, sometimes they do. So let's work hard at trying to bridge that gap and get back together again as best we can. I'll be right back with more right after this. Let me ask you, can the Catholic Church have a future if we Catholics don't understand our past? Experience history the way it should be taught in a new free online class from Christendom College. Just go to principlesclasses.com/Madrid.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
My number is 888-914-9149. Give me a ring. We'll get you on the air with your comment or question. Let's go to Richard now in San Pablo, California. Hi, Richard.
Hi. So I'm just calling about the role or the purpose of the Transfiguration. It was brought up in the RCI class, and mm-hmm. I figured, you know, let me call Patrick and get a good response for that.
Sure. You know, I'm struck by your question because it wasn't more than a day or two ago, 3 days maybe, that somebody called on the program and asked the very same question. And I don't think in all my years of answering questions about the faith that anyone has ever asked me that before. So to get two in the same week within a few days of each other is a record of some sort. So here's your ribbon, Richard.
I actually tried to call the last couple days to get in at the last hour, and I haven't been able to do that. So, I apologize.
No, don't apologize. I'm just marveling at the fact that the same question has come up twice in 1 week. In any case, so I, without having reviewed what I said a couple of days ago about this, as I recall, my point was that Jesus in the Transfiguration was bringing together the two primary figures of the Old Testament, at least in terms of the law and the prophets. So Moses, the law, and Elijah, the prophets, bringing them together, in a manner of speaking, with Peter, James, and John, who were this triumvirate was the, they were the chief of the apostles, and Peter being the chief of the chiefs. And so they represent the new covenant. So after Christ goes back to heaven, in the ascension, then these three apostles primarily, and the other apostles as a whole, they represent the new authority that supersedes now or completes or fulfills the authority, the law, and the prophets that was in the Old Testament. So as I read this passage, my understanding is that, number one, Jesus is showing by having these two groups of people together and that he is Lord over all of it because he is transfigured in their presence. So it shows that Moses and Elijah are beneath Jesus, as are Peter, James, and John beneath Jesus. And the transfiguration is a kind of a glimpse of his glorified, resurrected body before he died on the cross. So it was seeing him as he would be seen in his glory after his resurrection. Now, chances are I added a few more details to it, but I think that was the primary answer that I gave when it came up earlier. And I'll throw it back to you, Richard, but for what it's worth, if you're interested, just go back to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick, and just do a quick word search for transfiguration. And within the last few days, you're going to find that other call that came in, and you can listen to that question there as well. I gave a longer answer, as I remember. So those are my thoughts off the cuff. What do you think?
Okay, I appreciate that. And would you happen to have a book that you recommend for baptism? A gentleman is debating whether or not to baptize his young child, and his mother, you know, she was in my RCIA classroom last year. And so he's very methodical in regards to research and everything else. And so I'm not sure if you have anything along those lines for baptism.
Well, I mean, if you want a series of ancient sermons on baptism, I would go to St. Cyril of Jerusalem's Mystagogia. And that's spelled, do you have a pen handy? I can spell it for you.
Yes.
Okay. So Mystagogia. Gogia. And we would say maybe mystagogy in English. But this is a series of baptismal preparation sermons that he gave. This is in the 4th century. And they're very beautiful. And they're just filled with the church's teaching, not only on the meaning and the purpose of baptism, but also how it relates to life in Christ and all the other sacraments. So you can get that book in a single volume, but if he's looking for something that is rich in doctrine and explanation, that would be a great one to start with.
Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome. And appreciate the phone call. Let's go now to Darlene in Albuquerque. Good morning, Darlene.
Good morning, Patrick. I have a question. Me and my kids were coming from a catechism, me and my husband. We teach catechism on Wednesdays, me and my husband, and my older son is 14, my younger son is 11. We are coming from catechism, and we are talking about heaven, hell, and purgatory. Mm-hmm. So my older son, who is 14, says that we are able to, at the end of the world, when Jesus comes the second time, that we still have the choice of having purgatory, you know, as well as heaven and hell. And my husband said that no, at the second coming, when Jesus comes the second time, we will either go to heaven or hell. Purgatory will no longer be a choice. So we needed you to give us the right answer.
Well, ding, 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 ding. Your husband is absolutely right. Yeah, at the end of the world, not only is there only heaven and hell, but what we understand as hell now is going to be thrown into the lake of fire. So in Revelation chapter 20, beginning in verse 10, it says, "And the devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur where the beast and the false prophet were, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever." And we see, as this progresses in verse 14, "Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire." This is the second death, the lake of fire. "And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire." So point being that everything other than heaven and hell is done away with. So for the damned and for those who are in Hades, which could be understood, I mean, it means literally the underworld. So it's referring to where the good and the bad would go alike before the time of Christ's resurrection. But even afterward, we could understand purgatory as Hades. That's another way to think about it. But all of it is eliminated, and the lake of fire is the final destination for all those who are damned, and heaven is where all the blessed will be forever, and there's no third place at that point.
Okay. Okay, great. Thank you, Patrick. I appreciate that.
You're most
and
welcome.
Thank all of you at Irrelevant Radio. We are so blessed to have you all. God bless you guys.
Thank you. Kind of you to say so. And we are so blessed to have all of you. If you weren't there listening, we wouldn't exist. So thank you. I appreciate it, Darlene. Let's go to Jillian now in Eagle River, Alaska. Hi, Jillian.
Oh, good morning, Patrick. Thank you so much for everything you do.
Thank you.
Yes, I have a question. My husband and I teach high school youth group, and we got some deep thinkers in our group. And one of the students asked a question, and the question was, does Satan have the power to abdicate hell's crown?
No, he doesn't. His decision was fixed. It was permanent when he was tested. So God created all the angels, it seems, all at once. And however many billions or trillions of angels he created, they were all good. They were in a state of original innocence, you might say, similar to how Adam and Eve were before their fall. So when God gave the angels their test, it seems to have been some kind of a test involving whether or not they would serve God on his terms or prefer to be freelancers and do things on their own. But whatever the test was, those who failed the test instantaneously fell and became what we regard as demons. So the devils, the demons, and Satan being the chief, because Lucifer was the highest of all the angels, it seems. And so their decision, because they're angels, and this is true also of the good angels, their decision for God is permanent. It's irrevocable. And it's due in part to the angelic nature. You and I are different because we're rational creatures who experience things through our senses. We change our minds. We learn new information. We sin. We get back up again. We fall again in sin. We get back up again. So we are creatures who are created to be able to do those things, or are, you know, that's maybe not something that is a benefit to us necessarily, but that's how human beings are. Angels are not that way. So an angel knows something all at once, and everything that he can know about that, he knows about it in an instant. And his decisions are permanent. They don't change. They can't change, really. Not because he doesn't have free will, but because the way the angel's nature is that they instantaneously know exactly what they're supposed to know and what they're going to do or not do. So that's a big part of it. So for that reason, no, neither can Satan change his mind or any of the other fallen angels change their minds, nor can the good angels change their minds. And it's not because they don't have free will, but it's because their decisions are fixed and permanent. Now, I know that sounds maybe a little hard to imagine or difficult to think about, but that's the church's teaching on angels.
No, I had, Tony and I, we listen to you every morning, almost every morning when we can, because we're working. But then
You don't have to work, Jillian. Why don't you just quit and listen to the Patrick Madrid Show every day?
I would love that.
Is that
so
too much to ask? I don't think that's too much to ask.
Oh, Patrick.
No, it's not. Well, we were guessing what you would say, and this is so good. I'm so glad that we're learning so much from you, and we kind of got close to what you said. So thank you so much for everything you did. This is so helpful.
Oh, you're welcome.
I encourage the students to listen to you.
Thank you. You know, I'll tell you something. I found out from a couple of teachers recently, this would be, say, in the last 4 or 5 months, that listening to the program is actually part of the curriculum for their class. One of them, I think, was an eighth or ninth grade teacher at a Catholic school. And she includes on a weekly basis the assignment to listen to this program. And then there are specific questions the kids have to answer based upon what was on the program. I think that's fantastic. I don't know how the kids feel.
I think it's great.
But I think it's fantastic.
I think it's great. I'm going to make that a challenge for them. So I'll thank you for the advice. I'll do that.
I love it. Well, thank you, Jillian. I appreciate it. And of course, I'm only kidding about the job. You know, if you need to go, you know, just take all your PTO and listen to the program then. I'm just kidding. Live long and prosper. Thank you, Jillian. I appreciate the call. How about John now in Green Bay? Good morning, John.
Yes, good morning. I have a question as far as what is appropriate and what is not appropriate for handling of the Eucharist for the host during Mass. I am a caregiver for my mother, and I bring her to church. We do have the host brought to the pew because she's not so good on her legs.
Right.
And, you know, the lady hands her the host, and she doesn't always know what to do with it. And sometimes I'm having to, you know, it's kind of awkward because, you know, she'll maybe have it in her mouth half hanging out and like, oh, geez, you know, somebody did make a suggestion. Maybe you can break it in half and give her half and I can have half. And I didn't really think that was appropriate. But what is appropriate and what is inappropriate? You know, we've got all these different hands on the host, and I'm thinking, geez, what's happening here? And if it's okay, I would like to just hang up and listen to your answer on the radio.
As you like it. That's fine with me. And I appreciate the phone call. Well, there are, you know, certain things that should be done. So the person who's bringing Holy Communion should handle the host respectfully and prayerfully, depending upon the person receiving Holy Communion's physical capabilities. It can be placed in the hands, although I strongly don't recommend that, especially for somebody who, like your mother, doesn't really know what to do with it. It's far more appropriate, and I'd also say from a practical standpoint, it's far better to simply place the host on her tongue. So nowadays, there's such a strange shift in the direction of going to Holy Communion, receiving Holy Communion in the hand. It's most people receive communion that way. Now, go back 40 years or so, even less than that perhaps, very, very few people received Holy Communion in the hand. In 10 years or more before that, nobody received Holy Communion in the hand. Everybody received on the tongue. And that's how it was for, you know, well over 1,000 years, even longer. So the strangeness to me, it just seems very strange to me that so many people now, they're just reflexively receiving Holy Communion in the hand. But that's what the church now permits. So far be it from me to stand in the way of that, although I personally think it's far better to receive Holy Communion on the tongue. So in this case, my humble advice would be ask the extraordinary minister of Holy Communion to please raise the host before your mom's eyes so she can see this, and maybe you can ask her to open her mouth. Hey, Mom, you're going to receive Holy Communion now. You can tell her that quietly. And ask him to place the host on her tongue. That way she knows what it's there for, and she will be able to consume the host. Now, if that's not possible, a small fragment of the host can be broken off, and that definitely should be put on her tongue, not given to her in the hand, because if it's a very small particle, that would easily fall, and you might have difficulty finding it. So if she's not able to consume the entire host, then break off a small part of it, or the extraordinary minister should do this, break off a small part of it, place that gently on her tongue, and then you can say, Mom, you just received Holy Communion, you can swallow the host now. And I think that should be fine. I mean, there's nothing untoward about doing it that way, and it will help you avoid those terrible situations where the host might fall on the floor, or, you know, she might not eventually put it into her mouth and it might get in her clothing or something like that. You want to avoid those things. So that would be my advice in a situation like that. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Spam calls. You get spam calls? Well, there's a new way in which callers, including debt collectors, can reach you. I'll tell you what that is when we come back from this quick timeout. You're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show. on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. Let me ask you, can the Catholic Church have a future if we Catholics don't understand our past? Experience history the way it should be taught in a new free online class from Christendom College. Just go to principlesclasses.com/Madrid.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Since we're talking a little bit about angels this morning, I'd like to share with you what Frank Sheed had to say on the topic. He has written a number of, well, he's long gone now. He's up in heaven. I'm pretty sure he's up there by now, but he died in, I think it was 1982, if I'm not mistaken. But he wrote many different books, two of which I recommend frequently on the program. One is called Theology for Beginners. The other is called Theology and Sanity. Both excellent books. I would recommend you read them in that order, though. Start with Theology for Beginners. The reason is it's going to start exercising some mental muscles you didn't even know you had. And in the first book, he gets you sort of limbered up and prepared for the second book, which will take you deeper. But in any case, here is just a little bit. This is an excerpt from his book, Theology for Beginners. And here he's talking about angels. And then in a minute, I'll share with you a little bit of what he has to say about the fall of the angels, because that is a question that comes up quite often, and I think you'll find it interesting. So in the section on angels, he says, the universe God created has two vast divisions, spirit and matter. From the point of view of creation, the one difference between them is paramount. For while everything made by God bears the mark of its maker and tells much of him, spiritual beings alone are made in his image and likeness. We have here something like the difference between an artist painting and a picture of a landscape, say, or a friend, and the painting and him painting a self-portrait. The material universe is God's work of art, but spiritual things are his self-portraiture. Our own soul is a spirit, so that every man bears a portrait of God, painted by God within him. It is painted by God, for every soul is a new creation, made by God in his own image, but in most of us, the likeness of God is sadly defaced by sin. The angels exist, we know, by God's revelation. Science, which has developed marvelous skill in examination of matter, can make no pronouncement at all as to these beings in whom there is no faintest element of matter. We call them angels. The word means messengers because of so many instances in Scripture where God uses them to convey his will to men. But of course, they do not exist for us any more than we exist for them. We and they alike exist for God. Yet they are our mightier brothers, and their love and their protection are ours for the asking. What are they, all of them, but spirits apt for service, whom he sends out when he destined heirs of salvation have need of them, when the destined heirs of salvation have need of them. And that's a quote of Hebrews chapter 1, verse 14. When our Lord was in agony in Gethsemane, his Father sent an angel to comfort him. We sometimes need comfort ourselves. From end to end, Scripture is so filled with the activity of angels that it is puzzling to find so many Christian bodies ignoring them altogether, save as ornaments on Christmas cards. But even we who are Catholics overlook them very easily to our great loss. We know from our Lord's words that every child has an angel to guard him. And he's quoting Matthew 18, verse 10, where Jesus says, "See that you do not despise one of these little ones, for I tell you that in heaven their angels see the face of my heavenly Father continually." It is the universal teaching of theologians that this is not only of children, but of all. And yet we seldom turn to the angels for help. We tend to forget about angels simply because they are spirits. Matter is not so easy to overlook. Angels can nourish our minds as cows nourish our bodies. We are more solicitous for the nourishment that cows give. Fallen angels can damage our souls as microbes can damage our bodies, and we are more on guard against microbes. Sanity demands that we correct this strange defect in our thinking. The universe God called into being has in it these two great divisions, the world of spirits and the world of matter. It is a special reason for man's existence that he makes these two worlds, locks those two worlds, we might say, into one universe by belonging to both. He's referring to humanity. So our human nature is locked into both worlds, he says. Without man, spirit and matter would be two spheres, not touching. But man, and this is referring to humanity, belonging to one by his soul and the other by his body, joins them together. Think of the universe not as two unrelated spheres, but as a figure of, as a figure eight, with man on both sides of the join. Now, here's a few words that he has to say about the fall of the angels. He says, all spiritual beings, angels and men alike, are created by God with the beatific vision as their destiny, the direct vision of himself. All of them need supernatural life to give them the powers of seeing and loving that their destiny calls for. And for all, there is an interval for growth or testing between the granting of the supernatural life and its flowering in the beatific vision, referring to when you finally see God face to face. Once God is seen as he is, with the intellect in the immediate contact of sight and the will in the immediate contact of love, it is impossible for the soul to see the choice of self against God as anything but repulsive and, in the profoundest sense, meaningless. In the immediate contact, the self knows beatitude, total well-being, and no element of the self could even conceive of wishing to lose that. But until then, the will, even supernaturally alive, may still choose itself. So I'm going to pause there and kind of maybe paraphrase a little bit of that. His point is simply that once you see God face to face and you are so overwhelmed with bliss and joy and satisfaction and fulfillment and every single possible desire for happiness is just maxed out in terms of fulfillment, there's no way that you would ever say, I'd rather go do something else. It just becomes functionally impossible. He says, so it is with the angels. God created them with their natural life, pure spirits, knowing and loving, and with supernatural life. And some of them chose self as against God. We know that one was their leader. Him we call the devil. The rest we call demons. He is the named one, Lucifer, though he is never called so in Scripture. Satan, which means the enemy. Apollyon, which means exterminator. Beelzebub, which means the lord of the flies, or Beelzebul, lord of filth. The rest are an evil, anonymous multitude. The detail of their sin we do not know. In some form, it was, like all sin, a refusal of love, a turning of the will from God, who is supreme goodness, toward oneself. Theologians are almost at one in thinking it was the sin of pride. All sins involve following one's own desire in place of God's will. But pride goes all the way, putting oneself in God's place, making oneself the center of the universe. It is total folly, of course, and the angels knew it. But the awareness of folly does not keep us from sinning, and it did not keep them either. The world, well lost for love, that can be the cry of self-love too. One of the secondary theological excitements of the next life may be the learning the details of the angels' sin. The angels who stayed firm in the love of God were admitted to the beatific vision. The rest got what they asked for, separation from God. He still maintained them in existence out of their original nothingness, but that was all. Note that their choice was final. Men are given another chance, and another, not so angels. We have no experience, and never shall have it, of being pure spirits, spirits not meant for union with a body as our souls are, but philosophers who have gone deep into the concept see reasons why an angel's decision can only be final, and a second chance therefore pointless. The angels who sinned were separated from God. They must have known that this would mean suffering. God made them, as he made us, for union with himself. Their nature, like ours, is a great mass of needs, needs which only God can meet. All spiritual beings need God as, and immeasurably more than, the body needs food and drink and air. Deprived of these, the body knows torment, and at last dies. Deprived of God, a spirit knows torment and cannot die. It is deprived of God by its own will to reject God, but this will not change. Its self-love is too monstrous. The lost will not have God, who alone can meet their needs, but who, by the greatness of his glory, shows their own self for the poor thing it is. Union with him would be self-love's crucifixion, and self-love has become their all. There is more to be said of hell than that, and later more will be said, he's referring to the book, and that is the essence of it. One single detail must be added. Hell is not simply a place of self-inflicted torment, it is a place of hate. Love, like all good things, has its source in God. Cut off from its source, it withers and dies. It is as though the moon, in love with its own light, rejected the sun. Hell is all hate. Hate of God, hate of one another, hate of all the creatures of God, above all those creatures who are made in the hated image. One remembers the demons who preferred swine's bellies to a return to hell. And that's from Luke chapter 8. So there's just a little snippet, and if you like what you heard, I would encourage you to pick up those books and read them. They don't benefit me in any way, but I think it will greatly benefit you. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Peter in Chicago. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning. Patrick, I was just questioning the regards of at the Last Supper, Jesus breaking of the bread, passed the bread amongst his apostles. And he didn't place it on their tongue. And I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but the church, you know, has gone to the next step in passing. But I mean, at the breaking of the bread, when, and that's what the Mass is all about, and reconstructing that. You know, what am I saying? Are we making too big of a deal about the tongue? You know what I mean? Putting it on the tongue. And if I'm wrong, please correct me.
Oh, sure. No, I see your point, and it's absolutely true that at the Last Supper, Jesus handed the consecrated bread to the apostles. But the distinction there is that he had ordained them as priests. So it was at the Last Supper that he ordained them to be priests, and it's proper for the priest to handle the host at the altar. So that would be the reason why they were, why it was handed to them, but that would not, say, extend to lay people in general. So because we're not priests, we haven't been ordained for sacrifice at the altar, and our hands have not been consecrated for sacrifice at the altar, as have the hands of the priests who are ordained. So it may seem like a subtle point, but I think that's the fundamental reason. So there's no real conflict between Jesus giving the apostles the consecrated bread in their hands versus the church historically and traditionally, in the West anyway, placing the host on the tongue as opposed to in the hands. I'll note one other thing, Peter. In the Eastern churches, as well as the Eastern Orthodox churches, they've never, ever given Holy Communion to lay people in the hand. And one reason for that is that they commingle the precious blood with the Eucharistic bread, and they spoon it into their mouths. So they maintain the tradition intact, even though the church in the West has lost that custom largely by giving in to communion in the hand. It's unheard of and has always been unheard of in the Eastern churches. So that's another thing to think about when you consider this topic.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, I appreciate that. And that brings us right up to a break. So we have other people waiting. Those of you who are waiting, thank you for your patience. I'll come to your phone calls on the other side of this quick timeout. I promised you I'd tell you about you know, the people who can call you on your phone and bug you. Well, I didn't get to that, so I will get to that.
Yeah,
when we come
Patrick,
back from
tell
this
us.
Break. I will. Hold your horses. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. My number is 888-914-9149, and I'll be right back.